The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. On this Friday, before Labor Day, the Labor Department announces 173,000 jobs added to the economy in August, with unemployment falling to 5.1%. That's the lowest since 2008. Today, we're talking about the ethics of images that emerge from tragedies. Plus, Hillary Clinton remains under intense scrutiny over her emails. But 20 years ago, she asserted herself as an icon of women in politics when she declared that women's rights are human rights. All this hour, we're asking you, what's changed for women over those last 20 years?
This is Jason from Trumbull, Connecticut. Workplace compensation and promotions are still way off. I happen to work at a tech company where we try very hard to make this not the case. But the problem is still far from solved here and nationally.
More on that conversation later this hour, but we begin with the fate of prisoners housed at Guantanamo Bay Detention Center in Cuba. Almost 800 men have passed through the cells on that island. As of May of this year, 116 remain. Now, President Obama has been trying to shut down Gitmo since his first inauguration back in 2009. He ran on it in 2008, and he's continued to push for its closure ever since. Listen to him in 2013.
I think it is critical for us to understand that Guantanamo is not necessary to keep America safe. It is expensive. It is inefficient. It hurts us in terms of our international standing. It lessens cooperation with our allies on counterterrorism efforts. It is a recruitment tool for extremists. It needs to be closed.
President Obama there laying out the argument against Gitmo, one that his predecessor George W. Bush also made. But a renewed effort to shutter that prison has been complicated by a lot of issues. One of the biggest, where to house the detainees once they arrive on U.S. soil, whether they're awaiting trial or indefinite detention. Coming up, we'll talk with one Indiana Republican congresswoman who says she wants detainees kept far away from her state. But first, a look at how the Pentagon is scouting for a place to host America's own home Gitmo. I'm joined by Karen Greenberg. She's director of the Center for National Security at Fordham Law School. Karen, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Now, legally, where does this stand? For years, Congress has banned the transport of Gitmo detainees to the United States. Now the Pentagon is looking for a place for them. So where does this all stand?
Yeah, since 2011, the Defense Appropriations Bill has put a ban on transfers from Guantanamo to the United States. And that still stands. President Obama has made it clear that he would like that ban to be eradicated, but Congress has opposed him. Now, John McCain says that given a proposal that he accepts and that he can convince his colleagues to accept, he would work to get rid of that ban. So there's some headway, but no real headway.
So McCain says the Pentagon has a plan or needs to come up with a credible plan, and then you can convince lawmakers to go along with it.
Right. And the Pentagon is working on a plan, and we'll see what they come up with. But it is going to be a political quagmire. There's no question about it.
And it has been for many years. Now, Pentagon officials are quietly touring the country looking for a place where either an old prison could be retrofitted into a new Gitmo, highly secure for these high-value detainees and everything else, or a place where they could build a new one. Where are they looking? Do we know?
They are looking at a number of military and non-military facilities, starting with, as many people know, Kansas and South Carolina and Virginia and various places around the country. I don't think they're trying to make a secret of where they're looking, because eventually this is going to come up within each state and see if the president can convince people to host a prison there.
So you're looking at places in Kansas, I assume Fort Leavenworth, the big military brig there. There's a naval brig in Virginia, of course.
And in South Carolina.
South Carolina. What's being confronted by the communities around these places and by the lawmakers that represent them? Is it NIMBYism? We don't want these people here. Is it we won't be safe because wherever these accused terrorists are will be a target? What's the objection?
That's a very good question. I think it's a combination of both things, not in my backyard. backyard because it may be dangerous. But I'd just like to put out there a story about the beginning of Guantanamo. When Guantanamo was opened, there were several hundred military personnel there with their families. And they knew that the worst of the worst, as they were told, were coming to Guantanamo, and they had to take a vote. Will this be okay, or will this not be okay? And they all voted that it was okay and that they would stay. They were given the choice to leave. So this not in my backyard, it seems to me such a lack of confidence in the American prison system to be able to hold these people, not let them out if, in fact, they are convicted and determined to be held. So it's hard to say. I think it's a political football, much anti-Obamaism and the way in which the war on terror has divided the American public.
Okay, there are also lots of legitimate concerns over what kind of facility would be needed, a supermax facility or even supermax. They've been around this block once before. In 2012, the federal government actually did buy for $165 million an abandoned prison in Illinois. It's called Thompson. A lot of the lawmakers from Illinois, including Dick Durbin, the senator, were on board. They said, we're ready to host this. We want the jobs. We're ready to do this. But that all went away.
Yeah, because the political opposition was enough that they could rouse some kind of support for making it go away based on concerns of danger. Should these people get out, or who even knows? They didn't specify exactly what the dangers were. It was interesting how this prison in Marion, Illinois, all of a sudden seemed to evaporate the idea of it. And that's what's happened with Guantanamo repeatedly. Every time there's some kind of headway in terms of resolving the issues of removing these detainees, there's a problem. I think there's a further problem, which is that we're all focused on, should we bring them here? What prison should we put them in? What are we going to do? But the real issue is Guantanamo is synonymous with indefinite detention. And whether they're brought here as prisoners who are up for trial and convicted, or indefinite detainees, or forever detainees, as Carol Rosenberg for the Miami Herald has called them, is a real issue. And we're diverting ourselves from the real issue by focusing just on the danger or potential danger of moving them to American prisons.
And that's an issue we're going to get to with our very next guest. But first, I want to thank you, Karen Greenberg, Director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Now, some lawmakers across the country are not so happy at all about the Pentagon's scouting trips that we've been talking about. Congresswoman Jackie Walorski is a Republican from Indiana's 2nd Congressional District. She wants to keep Guantanamo open and the detainees inside. Congresswoman, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much.
Congresswoman, Pentagon officials have been snooping around your state looking for a potential place to put Gitmo detainees?
You know, I don't know specifically if they're looking around my state. My comments on this is because I'm on the Armed Services Committee and have been for the last 3 years. This is not a NIMBY issue with me. It's not like, hey, they're looking over the shoulder of somewhere in the state of Indiana. This is a huge risk, I believe, to our national security. And I've been involved in this, and I can tell you that I've been to Gitmo. And I've seen the facility. I've seen the advantages as to why it's been so secure. Geographically located around large body of ocean water has kept any kind of penetratable force out of there. There's been no escape. There's been no contraband. And there's been no, you know, issues around where Gitmo is. And so, but as I listen, as the Pentagon has exponentially increased their search, as your previous caller talked about, the search around prisons, around military compounds in our nation, I think it's a concern. And I think it's the issue of if you move them to U.S. military installations or U.S. prisons, we have contraband in U.S. prisons, i.e. cell phones, and we have recruitment potentials. We have recruitment right now in our U.S. prisons, and we have the issue of safety. And I think one of the reasons that we've been able to secure the folks that are high-ranking terrorists, high-value, very dangerous, often isolated in ways to keep our military safe and to be able to keep our detainees safe as well, has been evidenced in Gitmo. That's why, Todd, I'm saying this sounds so much like a political promise from the president. There is still no strategy. I'm on the Armed Services Committee. I was on the conference committee last year for the NDAA, and my language was in there with those Gitmo bills of not allowing the transfers back to this country. And I'm aware that the senator has asked for a plan. We've been asking for a plan for 2.5 years. There simply is no plan from this administration, and there certainly is not a plan from the Pentagon. I think all of us are ready to sit down and have serious conversations about this. There's been nothing to talk about. That's been the problem.
So aside from the fact that the president made this campaign promise, and of course he did, George W. Bush said he also wanted it closed. Congresswoman, what about the argument, which you've heard from the president and from some Republicans, including McCain and others, that in terms of America's national security interest, the symbology of Guantanamo cuts against that? We've seen ISIS prisoners in orange jumpsuits, a direct swipe at Guantanamo, and that the moral dilemma of Guantanamo and prisoners held without charge also cuts against our national security interests.
I would come back with this. I would say that we are also lacking any kind of strategic plan on the war with ISIL. And what if we get into a situation in the future where we end up having these same kind of prisoners that we need to get information from, we need intelligence from, to keep our homeland safe? I would say, what about the promise from our own president, who said the war from ISIL will never reach the shores of this country? And we do have an absolute war with infiltration because there's no strategic plan. So I think that, you know, we can all ask these questions, but the bottom line is that we cannot disagree upon is this. This administration has promised America a plan and has promised the Congress a plan as to what to do, not only with the war on ISIL, but with this issue with Guantanamo. There has been no plan whatsoever. And I just think, again, that we're looking at a political time issue. As time is escaping, this president's looking for a way out. But, you know, again, I've been there. These detainees are so dangerous, even to the hands of our military. The lengths that we have to go to protect our soldiers, most Americans would simply not believe.
This fight is going to continue. The president is going to try to close Guantanamo Bay before he leaves office. Whether or not he succeeds, in a large part, depends on a credible plan, the kind of plan that Congresswoman Jackie Walorski, Republican from Indiana, wants to see. Congresswoman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back. Todd Zwillick with you today, filling in for John Hockenberry. We go now to the conflict in Syria and Europe's refugee crisis that has produced a striking image, the photo of a 3-year-old Syrian refugee, Aylan Kurdi, who, along with 12 others, drowned attempting to cross the Aegean Sea from Turkey into Greece. The photo, which shows his small body washed up on a Turkish beach, inspired outrage that some argue had been missing from this tragedy until now. The journalist who took the photos, Nulüfer Demir of the Dogan News Agency in Turkey, said that when she saw Aylan's body on a beach, she was shocked and that the best thing to do was to make this tragedy heard. But do these images produce a real response or a fleeting sense of shock and dread? Will this photo serve as the tipping point in the Syrian civil war or the refugee crisis that has displaced more than 11 million Syrians over the last 4 years and magnified the plight of refugees fleeing from the Middle East and Africa? Maggie Stieber is a photojournalist who's worked in 66 countries over 3 decades, and she joins me now. Maggie, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, Todd. Thanks for having me.
How powerful an image, how salient was the world, do you think, or at least the West, largely ignoring this refugee crisis before they were shocked by the image of a 3-year-old's body in the sand?
Generally ignore things as human beings as long as we can. But I do think this image overnight has had enormous impact. This morning, David Cameron, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, who has been reluctant to take in Syrian refugees, has agreed to take in thousands. Also, the Canadian government is investigating why this gentleman's, the father of the young boy, had applied for refugee status or immigration to Canada. And he had money, he had family in Canada, he had everything. He was really a very good candidate, and why that was held up or denied. So that's being looked at. But I think what's happened with this one image is that now the West Western nations, which have, you know, to some degree, well, not even to some degree, I would say largely been reluctant to get involved with Syria, now sort of has no choice because of this one little boy's death and the picture, which is a very tender moment, actually, when you think about it. It's horrific and tender at the same time.
And people have reacted very strongly to this photo, some even saying initially that publishing the image was wrong. We all know that news agencies err on the side of sanitizing these things. Sometimes many didn't publish it. I can guess where you come down in this debate. The image needs to be out there.
Absolutely. And I really applaud The Guardian in Great Britain for publishing the pictures because there was a lot of discussion. I've worked in a newsroom before, and there's always a lot of discussion about photographs and how far one can go with them. And I think visual people always feel like it's not far enough, and word people, who we love, are often a little bit more conservative about it. Certainly, there was reluctance, but now I think it's on the front page of the New York Times. There's a whole story about this photograph and the family and what happened. And so overnight, and largely because of social media, people have had access to it. And I think it's gone beyond that part of the conversation as to whether this is a palatable sort of photograph to publish in local newspapers or on to be seen on television. I think it's gone well past that, and it has a life of its own. And I think it's largely because an image like this gets seared into people's brains and hearts, and it brings this sort of tragic mass exodus and escape from Syria right to the front of people's consciousness. And an image like that can reach deep down into your soul and wrench your gut, and it awakens our compassion in a way that other images haven't. Also, pictures of the dead are never shown. We tend to want to show the survivors, but the dead are ignored, and because people don't like to see that. But in this case, I think, as tragic as that little boy's death is, that at least this image might actually bring some changes that will help. I saw an image on this morning on television of a woman with a baby, a Syrian woman with a baby, laying on the train tracks in Hungary.
Yes.
In protest of the Hungarians not letting the Syrians board trains to go to Germany, which is also a burgeoning crisis right now.
There are certainly many, many other examples of the power of these images to shock the conscience. One can look back to photos of the Holocaust in the 40s. More recently, image of starving child with a vulture in the background, even images of Tiananmen Square and the Vietnam War. Maggie Stieber, you have said that a photograph can be a protest, and I think that's certainly true. Maggie Stieber is a photojournalist who's worked in 66 countries over 3 decades. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Todd.
And we want to know, what was your reaction to that photo? Do graphic images force people to realize the gravity of a situation, or do they only provide that temporary shock and disgust? On our Facebook page, Candace Johnson writes, people should have a choice. When did it suddenly become okay to insert pictures of dead people into news articles? I don't want to see a dead body to feel strongly about something.
This is Melissa from Florida. I was so distraught by this image, and I admit I broke down crying and watching my 1.5 and 3-year-old and just imagining what parents must be going through to make this treacherous voyage. So after collecting my thoughts, I went online to save the children and donated. So yes, this image compelled me to finally do something and help as much as I can from far away.
This is Catherine from Old Bridge, New Jersey. These images are critically important for people to see. It's one thing to read about refugees in abstract, but another to see consequences before you. They will live amongst hundreds of other photos from history that shocked people, like those taken at concentration camps in World War II, or Kevin Carter's photo of a vulture stalking a starving child in Sudan.
Sheva writes, both are true. Since people see what they believe they have no power to change, they seek to feel comforted in being shocked. That is to say, at least I'm aware. We always want to hear from you. Join this conversation on our Facebook page, facebook.com/The Takeaway. This is The Takeaway. We'll be right back.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
We spent a little bit of time last week bringing you up to date on Florida and the nasty fight over redrawing that state's congressional districts. Republicans are fighting each other, not just Democrats, in a battle over political advantage, fair representation, and minority voting rights. But Florida is far from alone. All across the country, from Texas to Arizona to Alabama and beyond, fights over redistricting are raging. They're weaving their way in and out of partisan state legislatures and the courts. In fact, 43 states have lawsuits pending against their current district maps, including Maryland. Here's Maryland Governor Republican Larry Hogan.
Fair elections and a healthy and strong competitive two-party system have been nearly impossible in our state. Maryland has been singled out for having some of the most gerrymandered districts in the entire country. This is not a distinction that we should be proud of.
Well, Maryland has a weird shape, and so do its congressional voting districts. The fight over redistricting, really, though, it's really about voting and who counts in a democracy. With more is Nate Persily. He's professor of law at Stanford University. Professor Persily, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Maybe it's easy to imagine that a couple of states, Maryland, for instance, might have a hard time agreeing on a map, but battles in 43 states? What's going on? Why all the dysfunction?
Well, I'd say the amount of litigation that we have this cycle is not atypical. You know, every 10 years or so, we redraw lines following a census, and then we go into court for the remaining 5 to 7 years to litigate about those lines. What's different is that the legal terrain has shifted in the process. And so, for example, there are some states that were previously covered under the Voting Rights Act, and the Supreme Court struck that down. And so now they have renewed possibilities when it comes to drawing lines. But it is true that these plans, which should have been in place for the 2002 election, are still in limbo in many of these states. And the controversies, as is always the case, focus around issues of partisanship and issues of race.
Right. I mean, there's a great deal of stake here that's obvious: political advantage and partisanship. I think we all get that. But no one is allowed to use these lines under the law to edge out minority voters. That's illegal. But it can still happen by using influence in another name.
Well, that's right. And part of the question now and always in these cases is, what does it mean, as you said, to edge out minority voters, or as I might ask it, to dilute their votes? What is it that you do as a line drawer in order to make sort of life worse for African Americans and Latinos? And there are several ways to do it, and it looks like all of those ways have been done at some point during this redistricting cycle, so that you have courts around the country looking at the questions whether you have over-concentrated racial minorities into too few districts, whether you have split them up among too many districts, whether you have used race too much in your thinking about drawing districts, so that you've sort of sent a signal that race is predominating in the districting process. We who draw district lines operating under these constitutional and legal theories often say that, you know, you can harm a racial group by packing, cracking, and stacking, which is to break them up too much, concentrate them too many, or otherwise dilute their vote.
And this is a big issue in a place like Texas. Let's talk about Texas for a second. There is a move there that in some ways would abandon the principle that everybody's heard of, one person, one vote. Now, this isn't to say that citizens don't get to vote, but the way you count the size of a district, like if it has a lot of immigrants who don't vote, or felons, or children, non-voters, it can dilute the power of everybody who has the right to vote. And that's a big issue in Texas right now.
Well, that's right. And it's going up to the Supreme Court in a case called Evanwill versus Abbott. And you have the plaintiffs in that case have said, look, it's unfair if I live in a district which is all citizens and everyone has an equal vote there. But in next door in the other district, voters who there are essentially have their district padded with where it's half non-citizen, right? And so and their vote is twice as much as mine because there are fewer voters there, even if there are the same number of people. And it's sort of strange that we haven't resolved this issue in the 50 years since the one person, one vote rule, but we haven't. And it has dramatic implications. I mean, if the court were to side with these plaintiffs who say that you should only draw districts around voters as opposed to around people, it would have dramatic implications for Latino political power in places like Texas and California, where the issues of citizenship are real ones when you look at the different districts.
So, Nate Persily, what's the outlook here? If you're a voter in Texas or Florida or Alabama or one of the other states that I mentioned, the power of your vote now versus the last time we had a census 10 years ago, how powerful is it?
Well, it really depends on who you are. At least that's what the plaintiffs in these cases will tell you, that for racial minorities in the South, you are in a different type of district than you would be if the Voting Rights Act were sort of full-throated and covering you. No one comes out and says, well, we've created a racially discriminatory redistricting plan. And so there are subtle aspects to each one of these plans that affect certain numbers of voters and then also provide for political advantage to the people who are drawing them.
Power, advantage, and the subtleties of diluting the vote. Nate Persily, professor of law at Stanford. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. Hillary Clinton is facing a bunch of problems at this early stage in the presidential campaign. The FBI is scouring her private email server to see if and how classified information was mishandled. A federal judge appears poised to order a search of her backup emails. And just yesterday, the State Department tech worker who helped set up that private email server in the first place invoked the Fifth Amendment in the face of questions from Congress and investigators. Now, the Clinton campaign has done its best to move on from the email controversy, but it's clouding an anniversary that Hillary Clinton wants to make an integral theme for the rest of her campaign, and it started 20 years ago, when then First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton stood before an audience of Chinese dignitaries in Beijing and defended women's rights.
I believe that now, on the eve of a new millennium, it is time to break the silence. It is time for us to say here in Beijing and for the world to hear that it is no longer acceptable to discuss women's rights as separate from human rights.
That was the United Nations World Conference on Women in Beijing, and the location itself was controversial, as China was then well known for its one-child policy, a law that led many Chinese families to abandon or murder baby girls. If they could have only one child, they wanted that child to be a boy. Now, out of that conference came the Beijing Platform for Action. That was a UN declaration to increase the number and power of women in politics across the world. This weekend, Hillary Clinton's campaign is using that anniversary here in the United States to launch a new initiative that it says will weave Women for Hillary themes into nearly every aspect of the campaign that could make her America's first woman president. But more broadly, two decades later, where do women in politics stand? Joining us is Ambassador Swanee Hunt. She's chair of the Institute for Inclusive Security. She's also very active in encouraging women to run for office. She also served as ambassador to Austria under President Bill Clinton. Ambassador, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Now, you were serving as ambassador to Austria at the time of that Beijing speech. Explain a little bit about what went on behind the scenes at the time prepping that speech. Hillary Clinton was first lady, after all, not secretary of state. It was a pretty big shakeup of protocol for a first lady to go onto a stage like that and say what she said.
Well, the big shakeup was whether or not she should go to China at all, because there was a lot of hue and cry about human rights abuses. And there were Chinese dissidents who were here in the United States and elsewhere speaking out. And so the China desk did not encourage her. In fact, they said it would be a real mistake to go. But the human rights desk in the State Department was very encouraging. And she made her decision. She said, you know, this is not going to be discussed anymore. I'm going and I'm heading this delegation, because she knew what she could do. She could connect the human rights issue to the role of women worldwide in increasing inclusive mode of security.
So 20 years after that speech, Ambassador Hunt, we've seen the elevation of horrible cases like Malala in Afghanistan winning the Nobel Prize, but also her terrible abuse. What is your assessment of the progress, maybe of the world's attention to women's rights as human rights, since that speech was made?
It's an excellent question. About 5 years after Beijing, there was a very, very important UN Security Council resolution. And it said women are not just victims like Malala. They are victims like Malala became, speaking out. And they must be key decision makers throughout the whole decisions about preventing war, stopping war, stabilizing. And one of those ways is to be in politics. And so one of the things that I do through our institute is to work in 40 different conflicts around the world and encouraging women to have the strongest voice they can so that policymakers put them at the decision-making tables, the negotiating tables. And then you end up with a very different peace agreement.
Of course, women gaining office and human rights for women, they're really not the same thing at all. There is a risk at times of women gaining seats in a parliament and everybody thinking, well, we've achieved a thing here without maybe any significant changes in policy. Where have you seen those policy changes or even cultural changes actually take root after more women get into the parliament or the city council or even the prime minister's office?
Oh, you're singing my song. I'm just finishing a book called Rwandan Women Rising. There you had a genocide. It would be the equivalent of 3.5 million Americans being killed, if you can imagine, in 3 months. And today, women are 64% of the parliament. They're half the Supreme Court. They're half the cabinet. And that country has leapfrogged over other countries in terms of education, and the lifespan has doubled. The World Bank has never seen anything like it.
How far has the world come overall? You mentioned the example of Rwanda. There are some basic facts that we've known now for a good long time, that basic control over reproduction, democratic rights, and even a small amount of economic opportunity, even if it's a microloan, can make an enormous amount of difference in the self-determination that women have, especially in poor countries. We're talking a little bit about electoral politics, but in a way, this is more important. How far do you think the world has come in recognizing sort of these basics?
Well, the difficulty here, and I'm sorry to talk about the negatives, like Egypt, where women are in Tahrir Square, and then they don't get themselves onto the Constitutional Commission, and then not one woman there. And then you end up with a terrible constitution that sets the country back, everything falls apart. And so I go to the UN, I say, why don't we have women in these negotiations anywhere across Africa? And the UN official says, well, the warlords won't have women because they're afraid that the women will compromise. Well, in fact, that is one of the tools that women have. They work across the aisles. They find ways to connect. And it's not just in Africa. It's not just in Egypt or Rwanda. They do this all over, including in the United States.
Ambassador Swanee Hunt, let's bring it back to the United States for a minute before we let you go. There are more women in the Senate than ever before, more women in the House than ever before. How would you rate the progress here in Washington, here in the United States, in women gaining office?
Well, in fact, the increase has been extremely slow. I hate to be a downer here, but the poor Republicans, they're 8% of the Republicans in Congress are women, 8%. Now, another way to say that is 92% are men. Okay. And the reason is the women can't get out of their primaries. They run at the same rate as the Democratic women, but they can't get out of their primaries because they're not radical enough. But the Democrats, instead of 8%, are in the mid-30s. And what a difference it makes as they work across the aisles. I mean, you'll remember that when we were about to fall off the fiscal cliff a few years ago, it's Susan Collins, a Republican, who stood up in the Senate and said, I have a compromise.
That's
was
true.
Like a day and a half, yeah, before. And it was Democratic women who joined her. That was the clincher, to see this Republican woman joined by Democratic women to save the country and the world from an economic implosion.
Ambassador Swanee Hunt, chair of the Institute for Inclusive Security, former ambassador to Austria under President Bill Clinton. Ambassador, thank you.
Thank you.
And here's one more thing to take with you today in the family car. Hey, this Labor Day weekend, gas prices are at the lowest price this time of year since 2004, down nearly $1 a gallon from last year. That's good news for the 30 million of you who'll be on the road this weekend. Hey, stay in the fast lane if you can. That's all for today. But if you are home this Labor Day weekend, tune into our Labor Day special hour on Monday. It's all about how we can meet the greatest challenges facing the United States and the world. We've got some great conversations for you in that hour. If you're in the car, of course, you can download our podcast and take it with you. Get it wherever you get your podcasts, including iTunes. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Happy Labor Day. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.
Public Radio International.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.